This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Daniel Lombardo loves Emily Dickinson's poetry. And he's more than just a fan. For a while, in the 80s and 90s, he devoted his life to her.
Dickinson has always been one of my central poets in my life, and I was extremely fortunate to spend 17 years of my career as the curator of the Emily Dickinson collection at the Jones Library in Amherst. Dickinson is considered not just one of the finest poets in America, but one of the finest poets in the English language. She's our Shakespeare. She speaks directly to one's heart. In fact, when my father passed away, all I could concentrate on was opening up Dickinson and reading what she wrote about death.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me.
The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the ring.
As a curator, we're trying to document a poet's entire life. So one of the things I was always hoping to find would be more either letters or poems in her own handwriting that would tell us more about her as a poet and as a person. So 1997, I was hosting an Emily Dickinson International Society conference at the Jones Library in Amherst. And I happened that month to get from Sotheby's their rare book and manuscript sale that was happening. And there was an Emily Dickinson original poem for sale. And this was not a copy of a poem that she had made several copies of. This is a poem nobody had ever heard of before.
That God cannot be understood, everyone agrees. We do not know his motives nor comprehend his deeds. Then why should I seek solace in what I cannot know? Better to play in winter's sun than to fear the snow.
The Holy Grail of the Dickinson world. It took my breath away. The estimated price was $10,000 to $15,000. I looked at that and thought, well, my library didn't have that kind of money. Nevertheless, I had the International Society there, and they got very excited. And they immediately started pledging money. And within 3 or 4 days, I had over $20,000, which I thought would be possibly enough to acquire it. I arranged to bid on the poem by phone, which can be pretty terrifying if you've never done it before. As the bidding started, it was going up by $1,000 every time somebody raised a paddle. Meanwhile, I'm on the phone, and if I wanted to bid, I just had to say, okay, bid. And the next increment, it would go up. And I knew 21,000 was the highest I could go. And it started slowing down, 19, 20,000. I said, bid, and went up to 21, and there was dead silence. And I got it. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary moment because the Jones Library is literally down the street from the Dickinson homestead. And to think this poem had gone from Emily Dickinson's hand to who knows where and traveled who knows where until it ended up 150 years later at Sotheby's on sale. And we were able to successfully bring that poem back to where it was originally written. At least that's what I thought. So the poem was announced in the New York Times. Time Magazine wrote about it everywhere that the Jones Library had acquired this unknown Dickinson poem. Concurrently, I was setting up a big gala reception and an exhibition for the poem in the library, so that by the end of July, 200 people would come from all over, from England, from all over this country, and we were to have a great celebration in honor of the return of the poem. But then a very, very strange thing happened. I got a call from Ralph Franklin at the Beinecke Rare Book Library. And he said, Dan, I got a call from a man named Brent Ashworth in Provo, Utah. And he says that he has seen this poem before, but he is concerned about where it might have been. He wants you to call him. So the next day I called Brent Ashworth. He said, Dan, I've been a collector for many years. I've bought many manuscripts having to do with the Mormon church. And I had seen this poem that you bought in the 1980s. You need to know I was offered this poem by Mark Hoffman. As soon as he said that, my blood ran cold, because I knew who Mark Hoffman was. I knew Mark Hoffman had been forging Mormon church documents. But I also knew that he had pipe bombed two people, and that he was in prison for the rest of his life. So if my Dickinson poem had been in his hands, it cast enormous doubt on this manuscript. I thanked him very much and then spent 4 to 6 weeks of the most intense weeks of my life trying to track this down, trying to prove that either it's authentic, that yes, I can trace this exactly from Dickinson's hand to where it had been, and prove that it's authentic. Otherwise, I needed to prove that it was a forgery. After that, I was on my lunch hour at the Jones Library and reading one of the books about Mark Hoffman. And at the back of the book, there were 100 pages of footnotes. And I'm flipping through those, and there's a footnote that says, Mark Hoffman also forged some literary documents. And there's Mark Twain, political documents, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Emily Dickinson. I was scared at that point. And I thought, this is damning. I have to keep going with this. I call Ralph Franklin again, and Ralph Franklin says, bring the poem down to the labs here and we'll see if we can learn anything more about whether or not it's a forgery.
That God cannot be understood, everyone agrees.
We looked at it through a stereoscopic microscope.
We do not know his motives nor comprehend his deeds.
Looked at it in raking light to look to see if part of the paper fluoresced.
Why should I seek solace in what I cannot know?
If it turned sort of a blue-purple, it meant that someone had put a certain chemical on it so that the forged either ink or pencil would take to the paper and look like it had been there a long time. We found some of that. At that point, Ralph and I both knew this is a forgery. These final pieces didn't fall into place until after I had to go before the world and say, we have this wonderful poem. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's wonderful, isn't it? And that was one of the great low points of my career, having to stand up in front of a group, not knowing whether I'd have to take back everything I was saying in another week or two. The last thing I needed to do was to reach out to Mark Hoffman himself. So I wrote to Hoffman and said, I've exposed this poem as a forgery. Would you like to tell me how you did it? And to my surprise, I got a letter from him dated September 30th, 1997, from Mark Hoffman from prison, a very detailed 2-page letter telling me in great detail how he forged the Dickinson poem. What he did was he went to the University of Utah Library and he found an edition of her poem, started reading it, and thought, yeah, I could do this. I could write a Dickinson poem. I could do her handwriting. And he goes to the back of a 19th century book and cuts out a blank page. Now, no scientist could tell anybody that's not a 19th century piece of paper. But still, he didn't just take a Dickinson known poem and forge her handwriting. He thought, I'll write my own poem. And then he says, well, she wrote so many poems, and he said, some of them are brilliant. Some of them I consider just drafts, he said. So what I wrote as a Dickinson poem, he said, was nowhere near her best, but he said, and I'm quoting him, I think it's better than some. He told me he thought he could write a poem that was better than some of Dickinson's own poems. One of my reactions to all of this was, how dare he? How dare Mark Hoffman take Emily Dickinson and desecrate her? Dickinson lived everything we are going to live in our lives. She somehow lived in her life, sequestered in Amherst, Massachusetts. She somehow connects with all of us. And for someone like Mark Hoffman to throw that kind of evil over her was dispiriting. It was awful. Because Dickinson saw through the hearts of people. She saw evil. She was a mature person who wrote about death and wrote about betrayal, wrote about blood. There's a great line. My life stood a loaded gun.
My life had stood a loaded gun in corners till a day the owner passed, identified, and carried me away. And now we roam in sovereign woods, and now we hunt the doe, and every time I speak for him, the mountains straight reply. And do I smile, such cordial light upon the valley glow, it is as a Vesuvian face had let its pleasure through. And when at night, our good day done, I guard my master's head, 'tis better than the eider duck's deep pillow to have shared. To foe of his, I'm deadly foe, none stir the second time on whom I lay a yellow eye or an emphatic thumb. Though I than he may longer live, he longer must than I, for I have but the power to kill without the power to die.
What would happen if Emily Dickinson confronted Mark Hoffman with her loaded gun of a life? I don't know, but Dickinson takes us there. Mark Hoffman took us to that meat of the bone in a different way, in a very evil way. I've gone on from that, and I'm somewhere at this point in my life at the middle way of, yes, we have on one hand Emily Dickinson, and we have Mark Hoffman on the other hand. They're both in the same world. In me, there's both Emily Dickinson and Mark Hoffman. I'm capable of both. We're all capable of both.
Daniel Lombardo. He was the curator of special collections at the Jones Library in Amherst, Massachusetts. We've been talking about Mark Hoffman on the show over the last few weeks. The story of Hoffman's forgeries and murders is being told in a series on Netflix called Murder Among the Mormons. And we think there's one more show to do about this story. We wanted to focus on the forgery part. When we come back from a break, the writer Simon Worrell will join us. He's written a book about the story of Hoffman's violence and the art in his forgeries. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Every time you tune in to KUER, you count on hearing trusted voices to bring you the news and to keep you company.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
From KUER News in Salt Lake City, I'm Caroline Ballard.
Here's your host, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Now, we're counting on you to bring these trusted voices to Utah. Support NPR Utah during our spring fund drive at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going back to the story of Mark Hoffman. He's the subject of a new documentary series on Netflix called Murder Among the Mormons. Back in October of 1985, Hoffman killed two people in Salt Lake City with pipe bombs. He wanted to cover up the forgeries he'd been making. Years and years of forgeries, many of them fake Mormon historical documents, but it turns out he tried his hand at American history, too. Phony signatures and letters, and as we've heard, at least one poem. There have been a number of books written about the Hoffman story, and we wanted to hear more about the forgeries themselves. So we reached out to the journalist Simon Worrell. In 2002, Worrell wrote a book called The Poet and the Murderer. His interest in this story came when he heard the news that an unpublished poem by Emily Dickinson had been discovered and was going to be auctioned at Sotheby's. Didn't think much of it at first, but later he noticed something in the New York Times.
It was just like a little insert in the column in the Times called Chronicle, I think it was. And it was just a tiny little three-line announcement saying the Emily Dickinson poem bought by the Jones Library has been returned as a forgery. And I remember putting down the paper and looking, we're having breakfast on a Sunday morning with my then wife, putting down the paper and turning to my wife and saying, wow, who is out there forging Emily Dickinson poems? And it was just that spark of curiosity, first of all. So I immediately called Dan Lombardo. And within an hour of him telling me what he knew by then, I knew I had an amazing story with Mormons and forgery and murder and Emily Dickinson and all of that. And I just, you know, the hair was standing up on the back of my neck.
Yeah.
And so I immediately wrote a pitch and put it out there. And I got a commission from Harper's Magazine. But that's how it all started.
Yeah.
And I was launched off on this extraordinary journey that I ate and breathed and slept for about a year and a half.
One of the things that I have to say interested me in your take on this story is the way you explored and got at the nature of truth. Because you mentioned in the book that you pretty quickly discovered that the truth, in quotes here, where Mark Hoffman is concerned, is a relative concept. Talk about the truth part that interested you, because it seems like the underlying theme in some ways in the book.
Hoffman was a master of deception, not just forgery, which itself is a deception, but he was a master of deception, of being able to convince people that what he was saying was the truth when it actually wasn't. And he used all sorts of methods for that. One of them was self-hypnosis, which he discovered as a teenager using biofeedback. And It's almost certain that he used the self-hypnosis. We can talk about that later, the complexity of forgery, for the forging process. But he also used it, you know, he would put himself into a sort of semi-trance when he went into a meeting to convince himself that what he was going to say was the truth. But you never quite knew with him. Indeed, his confession is full of half-truths or untruths, the confession that he eventually gave to Salt Lake City police after he was arrested. You know, and he manipulated the truth constantly about what he told his buyers or what he told the press about what his buyers had told him. And so you never really knew. And it had quite a corrosive effect on me, in a sense, because, you know, trust that you're Doug and you're saying you are a producer at the radio station and not a white supremacist in Nebraska underlies all human relations. You know, that we believe that each other when we tell each other things about our lives or anything at all. And of course, con men are masters of telling us absolute cock and nanny stories, but convincing us that those are the truth. So it made me wonder, you know, what is true and what's not, and how much of what we take for truth in the world is actually not. And then the question of, well, am I always truthful? Yeah. You know, do I probably tell little half lies as well to protect people's feelings or whatever.
Or to get what I want, whatever minor thing.
Or to get what I want, yeah.
Yeah, we all do it, right? I mean, on some.
Yeah, small and or large, in his case.
Interesting how you implicate yourself and the rest of us in this story. That's fascinating, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have a fairly flirtatious or complex relationship with the truth. And, of course, Hoffman had a very complex relationship with the truth, and keeping secrets, that's another thing, because of course Mormonism, it trains you to keep secrets. You have to swear that you won't reveal any of the rituals or gospels or any of that, any of the inner workings of the church. So he was already trained from childhood as a master of secret keeping.
I want to back up a moment and ask you about what you write about the history of forgery, because this was really interesting. You write about the art of forgery. I guess that's the right term. You say literary forgery is older, in fact, than the English language. And you mention how thousands of years ago the ancient Egyptians were dealing with forgeries. Talk a little bit about what you learned about the complicated history of all of this.
Right. I mean, there's been numerous examples. I mean, right back to ancient Japan, there were forgeries there. And as you mentioned, the ancient Egyptians. And then in European civilization, there was a long, long history of forgers. Most of them were pretty bad. I mean, when you look at some of them, like there was a 19th century French forger called Denis Vrain Lucas. He created numerous so-called epistolary conversations between historical figures and actually never took place. So between Alexander the Great and Francis Bacon to Galileo, he just made all this up, or Richard the Lionheart to his troubadour Blondel. You know, he did great research, so he got all that part of it right. But the actual forgery was very, very minor, amateurish, really, compared with Hoffman. And I would put Hoffman really at the very pinnacle of the art of forgery. There have been some very good historical forgers. Samuel Ireland in the 18th century was a rare book dealer. He did very fine forgeries, but he made also elementary mistakes. And it's interesting how different motivation, what is it? So if in Ireland's case, it was a sort of avenue to celebrity. He wanted to make his name by supposedly digging up these. Thomas Chatterton was a young poet, maudit, as the French say, a doomed poet figure. So his motivation was celebrity. For others, it's money. For Hoffman, it was more complicated. It was money, definitely. He made a lot of money from his forgeries, but it was also a darker mission, and that was his taking revenge on the Church of Latter-day Saints, which he felt betrayed by, oppressed by, and generally blamed it for anything that was wrong in his life.
Well, you mentioned this was one of the insights. I hadn't realized that money is a, you say, a comparatively recent motive for forgery, which gives you a sense of how much more complicated motives are when you're talking about forgery.
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of different reasons that people become forgeries. Some of it is just, and that's definitely true of Hoffman as well, is a sort of pleasure in fooling people, fooling the experts. Pull the wool over the eyes of the old gray men of the Mormon Church.
So I wanted to ask about the part of Mark Hoffman that you explore, as you say, not just a brilliant craftsman, but a master of psychology. It seems clear Hoffman, as you said, took some kind of perverse pleasure out of just deceiving people.
Mm-hmm.
What seems harder to figure out is, you know, what was his principal motive, even if that's worth looking into, because he seemed to be motivated by all kinds of things. I mean, as you say, he had this disaffection for Mormonism, feels like he'd been deceived by the church story and by church leaders and wanted to undermine the church.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's, of course, money. That was clearly it. And so it's hard to tell whether this is deeply complicated, his motive, or it was kind of quotidian. He was just looking for money. He was looking for a kind of a thrill of it. I guess we can't say for sure, but maybe it's all of the above, right?
It's all of the above, definitely. All of the above. I mean, definitely money was a big motivator. He realized that he could make money, and quite a lot of money, with forgery. There was also the sort of sadistic pleasure of sticking it to the Mormon Church. And that all comes, you know, as you know, from his childhood, where he had a very oppressive authoritarian father. He had a sort of awakening in England when he was on mission. He read a lot of banned Mormon books and started to discover that what was actually being taught was maybe not quite the truth that he was told. And then there was a particular personal thing about it was his aunt who was in a polygamous marriage in a Mormon community in Mexico. And he discovered this, and this had all been hidden in his family story, and his father and his mother refused to acknowledge it because polygamy had been subsequently banned. And this was a sort of another axe for him to grind. And yes, and I think the feeling of, you know, he had been repressed and he, you know, there was no dialogue in his family. If he had questions, they were just slapped back down. And that developed into a kind of inner rage, I think, against the authorities and authority figures. So money, embarrassing the Mormon Church, which he took delight in, clearly, you know, the famous thing where having sold them a fake, he then alerted the newspaper, the LA Times, to tell them that while they were hiding it away in the vault. So they were caught, you know, hiding a forgery, were caught with their pants down, as it were. And then, of course, celebrity as well for him. He becomes the magic man. He becomes the most celebrated Mormon document dealer in America, bar none. He had the magic touch, as somebody said. You know, Rick Grunder, I think I dealt with an antiquarian. He said, you know, we just could never fathom how he could find these things. You know, all of us were looking, but he always found them. He had this magic touch. He was the magic man, we called him. And so he became famous in Salt Lake City among church circles. He was celebrated for his discovery of the Anton transcript. He was in the newspapers. His name was all over the world in the Mormon newsletters as this brilliant young man who'd done this great service to the church by finding the Anton transcript. So it's all mixed up in there. And then I think the sheer pleasure of the craft of forgery. I think he enjoyed it. You know, he had his basement lab, and he'd go down there, and a bit like an artist or an engraver working down there, you know, he liked it. He was good at it. You know, some people do woodwork, and he did forgery.
What about this idea that talking about how good he was at this, because I've heard this a bit, that when you talk about how good he was at it, that it somehow diminishes the effect of his crimes, that sure, he may have been talented and gifted, but saying so somehow diminishes the fact that he killed two people and deeply hurt many others. What do you say about that? How are you responding to that idea?
I know that. I know people have said that. Shannon Flynn said that, you know, was he good? Yes. Do I admire him for that? No. I don't think it changes the horrendous nature of his crimes just to say that he was a brilliant forger. He was a brilliant forger. You know, you can't take that away from him. Of course, he then went on to commit two horrific crimes because he was, you know, the deception was about to be unmasked, and that was when he turned to crime. But I don't think there's any doubt that in the history of forgery, he probably stands at the very top of the pinnacle of the tree, just in terms of the technical brilliance of many of these forgeries. I mean, I started, of course, the book started out with, and there's a great deal in the book about the Emily Dickinson poem.
Yeah. So let's forget for a moment then the other kinds of techniques that he used, that, you know, he figured out how to age the paper and get the ink right. And let's forget the postmarks that he faked. Let's forget the way he stole paper. Let's just talk about the writing itself, the skill at mimicking the handwriting of another person, which I guess is fairly distinctive. You do write about the various things that influence handwriting. So talk a little bit about that, if you would.
It's incredibly difficult to forge, imitate somebody's handwriting. And most people get caught through an obvious thing that you would do if you and I tried to forge, is that you hesitate. You're not quite sure that that's the way that E goes. And so you pause mid-stroke. And hesitation is always the key, you know, mark.
That's a giveaway.
That's a giveaway. And that's what any authenticator will look for, is signs of hesitation. And it's incredibly difficult to write somebody else's handwriting without hesitation. And that's, first of all, because it's incredibly difficult to write. The number of muscles and nerves and reflexes that we're coordinating as we write is legion. I mean, it's a hugely complex physical and psychological process. It becomes what's called an overlearned process, so it becomes automatic, but that's automatic for you. But it's not automatic if you're doing somebody else's writing. It isn't overlearned then. You have to imitate it as you go along.
You mentioned, Simon, I just wanted to point this out, that scientists have isolated, I think you say, 9 different, I describe them as processing stages in the act of writing. So it's really complicated.
It's really complicated. In the act of writing one letter, I think that was.
Right.
9 different phases in the act of writing one single letter. How do you go about it? How did he so successfully do it? Well, I posit the theory. He's never really admitted to it, but I posit the theory that he was using basically self-hypnosis. Right. As he used that, he did say, admit to beat a lie detector test with, I think, a plus 12 score.
Yeah.
You know, he sailed through the lie detector test because he put himself into a trance-like state. He'd been dabbling in that since he was a teenager. He was very fascinated by a book by a magician he had seen perform. I describe it in the book, called Peter Revine. And he did these sort of magic shows where he put people under on the stage, and they did strange things. They kind of walked like a goose or did things that they would never do. And Peter Revine wrote a book called The Superconscious Mind, and that definitely was a big influence on Hoffman, of the extraordinary potential of the human mind.
I have to say, I remember Ravine making the rounds. He was everywhere. I think in the mid-70s, and this is where Mark Hoffman found hypnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe that when he did a forgery, he used the same techniques. He sort of put himself into a trance. He did a few practices, I'm sure. Emily Dickinson, he said he did 3 or 4 passes at it over a period of 3 days. And then comes the moment of truth, and everything is right about that Emily Dickinson poem. And particularly mind-boggling, because we know that And that's why the greatest expert on her handwriting and her so-called fascicles and manuscripts, Ralph Franklin, was fooled, was because when he looked at the copy of that, he checked all of his handwriting charts and he said, nobody could possibly know this, nobody except me. Of course, it then became clear that his book, The Fascicles of Manuscript Books of Emily Dickinson, was Hoffman's source. And in it, he found all of these charts showing the way that her writing had changed over the decades of her life. And specifically in 1871, you know, nothing was to chance in that forgery. He chose 1871 because she had serious problem with her eyesight and her handwriting was kind of fracturing apart. At that time in 1871, she was doing different letter forms. For instance, the letter E had two different forms. The letter D had two different forms. And Hoffman incorporated all of that in that short poem that he himself invented, you know, act of bravura. It wasn't a great Emily Dickinson poem, as one expert said to me. If it was Emily, it was Emily on a bad day. But it was good. It was good enough because, again, why choose 1871? Well, because she was writing these kind of little wisdom pieces, they're called, at that time, quite a few of them. They're a bit like Hallmark cards, you know. She didn't always write a tour de force poem. She wrote these little pieces. Often another detail he put in, often she gave them to children. So what do we find on the back of that sheet? We have a signature in red pencil, different pencil, Aunt Emily. The implication being that little simple wisdom piece, that God cannot be understood, was written for a child. And as he's writing the poem, he's using all those different letter forms. And he's doing it as though he is Emily Dickinson. In fact, I start the book, if you remember, with an imagined scene where he puts himself into this trance and he brings pencil to paper and seamlessly, without hesitation, that's the key, without pausing for a single split second, he writes all of those letters, those sentences, that poem. And then, only then, you know, lifts his pencil. And there cannot be any hesitation. The smallest hesitation, which a document authenticator would see, would give it away.
Yeah. You say that Hoffman had this sense of how flimsy the wall is between reality and illusion, and that he understood this impulse that people had to believe or want to believe, to embrace that illusion. Do you think that's part of why he was so good?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he saw it as a dealer. He saw the collector's eyes light up. It's what's called the willing suspension of disbelief. You want to believe in this thing. He saw it in the operation of the auction houses, where people bought things that they might, in a saner moment, know were questionable, because the auction houses sell a lot of forgeries all the time and frauds, fake pieces of furniture or whatever, or stolen goods. But people want to believe. And the same with that's why the Emily Dickinson poem partly got through, because everybody, Dan Lombardo, the librarian who bought it, he wanted to believe that this was a brand new poem, the first in 40 years, and that they could bring it home to Amherst. It was going to be a huge thing for their town, for the community. And so, yes, absolutely, this is a key part of his whole modus operandi, is knowing that people want to believe. People want to believe that that he has discovered the first printed document in America, the Oath of a Freeman. He sees their eyes light up. They want to believe in it.
Would Mark Hoffman have gotten away with his forgeries in a different time, in this time, where people have access to information on the internet, where you'd think it would be harder to fool people today, at least in terms of the backstory part? But the digital age wouldn't have changed his skill as a forger, actually. So I'm wondering what would be different, if you think anything, today.
I don't think a lot would be different. Huh. I mean, he was a master researcher. You know, he was a bit like a novelist researching a story, and then he puts together the story and the forgeries, of course, you know, he is a master storyteller, and they all tell stories that people want to believe. They want to believe Emily Dickinson wrote this cute little poem for a child. So I don't think that, you know, he was meticulous in the researching and provenancing. He invented some elaborate provenance, because a lot of forgeries get caught out on the provenance. You know, who did this come from and where did it come from? And for instance, in the Anton transcript, he's traveled back to the Midwest and he found a Bible, and he constructed a very plausible provenance, a story that explained how he had come to find that Bible with the page inside it where he found it. And so I don't think any of that, you know, you would have typed in whatever Anton's transcript now and before, if often hadn't existed, and you would have seen all the information about it, which he found out himself. Whether the forensic science of detection and authentication has moved on a lot and would make this easier, I'm not sure. I have not spoken to George Throckmorton for a while, who's the guy that, as you know, that in Salt Lake City, brilliant guy that actually cracked the forgeries when he found the cracked ink.
Yeah.
I imagine things have moved on. Technology does move forward. And whatever tools and machines they were using then are probably even better now.
You say when you first started this journey that you didn't really know all that much about Emily Dickinson. And I wonder how your relationship with Dickinson's work has changed. I mean, didn't know much about her. Then you start exploring her life, dig into, and of course, this effort to forge a poem of hers. Do you spend any more time with Emily Dickinson's work than you did?
Yeah, I mean, I got to know this rather kind of crackpot, oddball, brilliant, gifted genius, you know, through her work, through going to Amherst, seeing her lonely little room there where she wrote all those poems locked up on the, in her first floor bedroom where she stored them all in that locked box where they were eventually found. None published in her day, you know, the loneliest of artists, really, a bit like Van Gogh, very few, but Van Gogh actually did have some work, you know, sold and distributed. She had none at all, but she kept on going. These were her sort of torch songs of her soul. You know, I think she's a beautiful, eccentric, funny, sarcastic often character who produced some of the greatest modern American poems that are so modern in their syntax and in their sentiments and everything, and that have left, you know, they're a unique body of work that you can compare to sort of outlier artists like Van Gogh.
Simon Worrell, did you leave the story of the poet and the murderer after the book, or did you want to come back to it?
No, I pretty much left it. I didn't feel there was much more that I could find out. I felt like I dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. I never did get to interview Mark Hoffman. I tried, as everybody does, as the Netflix people did, but I think it's the last little shred of his power that he has, that he can turn people down.
Well, it's been more than, well, nearly 20 years since you published the book at first. And at the time,
yeah,
you said you felt you had come as close to the truth that you could possibly get. Do you still feel that way?
I do. I can't imagine short of being able to sit down with Mark Hoffman and grill him. I can't imagine there's anything more that I could find out. I still have a few unanswered questions. The roles of various characters around Hoffman. Shannon, if you're listening, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to say this. I was never quite sure what Shannon Flynn knew or didn't know. I'm going to hope that he didn't know, as he has always repeated, and I'll trust him for that. And I also had a few doubts about Doralee, Hoffman's wife. the extent to which she knew or didn't know. Again, benefit of the doubt, you know, she was a obedient Mormon wife, and, you know, you didn't ask questions. When her husband went down to his basement laboratory, you didn't go down. You didn't see what was going on. So in both cases, I always wondered, but I'm going to give benefit of the doubt.
Simon Worrell, his book is The Poet and the Murderer. There's a new revised digital edition of the book out now. We'll put a link to it on our website. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. We had help this week from April Fossen. She read the Emily Dickinson poems for us. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.